BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts. Las Vegas, just after 10 p.m. on Sunday, October the 1st, 2017. More than 20,000 people were enjoying a music festival on Las Vegas Boulevard. Country singer Jason Aldean was on stage when suddenly his performance was interrupted.
There was like four random shots that came out, which I had mistaken for fireworks, and evidently there was no fireworks around, which was then sort of followed up with 11 minutes of bullets and automatic gunfire constantly. Now, I have never been in a situation with gunfire, and we just sort of ran.
Stuart McCormack was at the festival with his wife when 64-year-old Stephen Paddock holed himself up in a hotel room overlooking the event and started firing indiscriminately at the people attending.
It was a case of just trying to run back to your safe place, which you didn't really know where that was. Thankfully, we never were in the bits where we've seen people getting harmed, but we got away early enough.
Tragically, a lot of other people didn't. 60 people died. At least 413 were wounded. Another 400 injured in the panic that followed. Stephen Paddock was found dead an hour later with a self-inflicted gunshot wound. He'd committed the deadliest mass shooting by a single gunman in US history.
There was a lot of anger, a lot of grief. Although you didn't know anybody who passed away personally, you think to yourself, did I rub shoulders with somebody who's not going home? Me and my wife's hardest part was that was our honeymoon. So always attributed to being married would be this happened 2 days later. And we thought we could never separate those memories, but thankfully at this point we can.
Stuart first got in touch with me last October, 6 years after that fateful day in Las Vegas. His message read,
I was just wanting to reach out as I'm a survivor of the Las Vegas mass shooting and actually suffered from attacks online. I would also love to discuss the process of how I fell down the rabbit hole of conspiracy surrounding my own tragedy.
I'm Mariana Spring, the BBC's disinformation and social media correspondent. And in this series, Radio 4's Why Do You Hate Me?, I'm investigating extraordinary cases of online hate. I'm meeting the people at the heart of these conflicts, and in some cases, bringing them together to see if understanding, even forgiveness, is ever possible. I get a lot of messages. Some of them are abuse directed at me, but others are from people like Stuart, who want to talk to me about their own stories. Stuart's message really stood out to me. I've heard from lots of people who've lived through attacks and tragedies and who have experienced online abuse, but never from someone who ended up believing conspiracy theories about the traumatic event they survived. We messaged and chatted several times before I headed out to meet him in Northern Ireland, where he lives. I wanted to find out more about how Stuart had fallen into and then rejected these conspiracy theories. He lives with his family in a picturesque village by the sea in County Down, about an hour's drive from Belfast.
It's very rainy.
Yeah, the weather's been terrible for you since you've gone here. It's normally quite nice in this area if you can get the sunshine.
Stuart's in his mid-30s, and despite what he's been through, he has a wonderfully dry sense of humour. He has short brown hair and is casually dressed in a grey hoodie. He'd never really been one to campaign online, but after returning home from Las Vegas after his honeymoon, he started posting in favour of greater gun control in the United States. He says he was traumatised by what he'd witnessed, and the tweets he posted prompted a range of responses.
Some people would have had a debate with you and say, look, you can't remove guns now, it's too late, we just got to accept what we have, which is a weak excuse. And then others had said, like, if you come back here, we'll happily finish the job.
How much was posting on social media part of your way of trying to make sense of what happened?
It was the way I could vent. Because the incident happened so far away from home, there wasn't much support around the incident at home. So my connection to America was via the awful social media platforms that you could use. And so for me, it was just spitting out raw feelings and raw opinions towards things. It was my way of communicating it. I had like a superhero complex. I wanted to go back in and save everybody, but I didn't that night. So my grief was that I didn't go in and stop more of this happening. I couldn't have. And so you could just go and shout in social media and everybody that wanted to would hear it. But in the same breath, people would give you their opinion back.
What Stuart also found difficult was that the shooter seemed to have no obvious motive for doing what he did. So what began as an emotional online campaign soon descended into an obsession with finding out more about what had happened that night in Las Vegas. And with that, he discovered lots of false allegations about what had unfolded.
Tell me about when you first encountered more conspiratorial content or disinformation about the attack. How did that happen?
Well, you fell down a few rabbit holes, so there was never clear answers. Initially, I thought the police force in Las Vegas done great jobs, you know, and then you read a few wee bits online, again through social media platforms, connecting with people online who you thought were trusted allies, I won't say friends, allies in this situation. And then they would start saying stuff like, I'm here and Saudi Arabia was involved in this and this was a cover-up. And because there was no motive and no answer, you just pulled at every thread to see which one made the most sense to you, which one probably related to your theory the best. And that's how you fell into these conspiracy theorists.
Stuart's fixation began with one particular account. Its username was Wegg Oge. He came across it on Twitter, now called X. But Wegg was also active on YouTube and Facebook. Wegg's account posted some factual content about the shooting, details which Stuart found useful.
Wegg had a funny picture, and I don't know the origins of coming across it, but it was one that I found he put up as much fact as he could, along with as much theory. So when I say fact, I mean he would have just produced like police reports and the stuff that was being released into the media. And then he would have also explored what that could lead to. I also found him very quick. So if I was finding information out that was being released within 24 hours, he was uploading the information, which bridged that gap for me being so far away.
But it also discussed a number of conspiracy theories surrounding the Las Vegas shooting. One suggesting that a Saudi prince had been the real target and the victims were collateral damage. Another, that a hotel worker who tried to stop the shooter was really a government plant of some kind. And a third, saying that a helicopter flying over the hotel that night had been firing the bullets. I've trawled through Wegg's account myself, and what underpins all these conspiracy theories is the belief that the shooting had been staged by government and security services in some way, contrary to the evidence available. Stuart found himself obsessed with the content Wegg was posting online. He would spend hours and hours each night looking at it. He even went as far as printing it all off and storing it away in folders, which he now keeps in a black bin bag in his attic.
Let's take a look at this bag.
These are some of the information that the Wegg account would have supplied. This was the large part of the investigation report on it. And then there's multiple folders in here that would just be supportive information there, like voluntary statements.
Yeah.
Of what happened.
And why did you print it all off?
It was just the fear that it would be taken down before I could, in my head, read it all, but I haven't really read much of it. What I did was took Wegg's lead in pointing out parts, and then I would work my way through and sort of note important pages that would have been referenced there. Mm. So it would have.
Stuart's increasing fixation with Wegg's account started to take its toll. He was struggling to process his trauma. He says the conspiracy theories Wegg's account discussed were part of his way of making sense of what had happened. But they also left him feeling paranoid and isolated.
During the times when you weren't mentally well with all this, I believe when I was talking on social media that I was being tracked by America. These were the theories in your head. If I went back to America, somebody may detain you. I'd be like, you're getting too close to the secret here. Not that I was in the conspiracy game, but you were pulling at the threads and you worried about these things. So you became sort of reclusive with your information. You know, keep it all to yourself. You needed a crutch. And this was my crutch. Find the answer and then you can move on.
Stuart asks me whether I can find out who Wegg is. Who is behind this account, which had played such a big part in his life? I don't have much to go on. The username seems to be a pseudonym, and all of its profiles on the different social media sites use a picture of the 16th century astrologer, Nostradamus. I send messages to all of the accounts, but those go unread and unanswered. So then I start contacting anyone I can find that Wegg had interacted with online. One woman who appeared in Wegg's photos tells me she can't remember his real name. Another man who replies ran a big conspiracy theory YouTube channel, but doesn't have any contact details for Wegg. Others don't respond to me. I've almost given up, but then one person replies saying he has an old email address for Wegg. I send a message to that address and wait. Finally, I receive a response, and he says he's happy to have a call. When we speak, he tells me his real name is Joel, and he lives in Phoenix, Arizona. He's really polite and friendly when we chat. I can't believe I've found him, nor can Stuart. Wegg's content played a huge part in Stuart falling down the rabbit hole, convincing him that the shooting was actually a government plot. But he says these conspiracy theories were also something to hold on to at a distressing time. Stuart no longer believes these theories, but is still really intrigued to find out more about Wegg, the man who helped him through a traumatic period in the most unorthodox of ways. And now we've found him, Stuart wants to meet Wegg in person.
To be honest, I'm excited to meet somebody who, for a year of my life, was quite important. Do you know what I mean? It was part of probably falling apart, which allowed you to get better. Do you know, he was in that period of when it was crashing down. I'm hoping it's like a real good thing, you know, to track down somebody who didn't really exist and actually have him 6 feet from you.
So I ask Wegg whether he'd be interested in meeting Stuart. I explain what a big impact his content has had on Stuart, and amazingly, quite quickly, he agrees. He's somewhat retired from his Las Vegas conspiracy theory days, but he says he dedicated so much time to the content, he wants to know how it affected his followers. He has some reservations, but after he's checked me out online, he's in. And so, Wegg flies all the way from Arizona to Belfast, ready to meet Stuart face to face. We found a quiet cottage to meet in, a few miles from where Stuart lives. Wegg and Stuart are both nervous, and the relief is palpable when they finally shake hands and sit down next to each other.
Stuart, this is
Wegg. Hi, Stuart.
Wegg.
Do you know me as Wegg, I guess?
Yes, how are you?
My real name's Joel, so...
Come on in.
Nice to meet you.
Take a seat.
You're not how I pictured you.
Yeah.
I'm
sure you saw my profile picture. It's Nostradamus. So, yeah, I look nothing like him, I don't think.
Wegg is in his early 40s and his hair is slicked back. He's dressed head to toe in brown.
Tell us about Wegg. Where does that name come from?
So I made it up and it doesn't come from anywhere. I just needed something to register new internet accounts that weren't associated with my true identity, and it was easy to type. I would never have been able to guess that I would eventually start being called that in like real life by people.
Why did you choose that event then? Why was it the 1st of October, the mass shooting?
Mass shootings have always been, I guess, an interest of mine in just looking into, because I try to understand them, why they happen, what's the cause, what's the motive. When the Vegas shooting happened, I felt that there was a huge gap between what was being reported by the mainstream media and what was being reported by just like people on YouTube that seemed to have access to a lot more resources than the news channels did. The other part of it is that Vegas is one of the closest vacation destinations to where I live in Arizona. Mm-hmm. So Vegas in particular has a place in my heart, I guess you could say.
You mentioned you were interested in other shootings before. Had you ever posted about them on social media before?
Mm-mm. No. Maybe like a little question here and there, but never had I gotten this interested in it to the point where I felt that I needed to create, you know, an alternative identity or secret identity to start to look into things.
Why did it have to be a secret?
If I'm being honest, part of it was that when I first started researching, I had no idea where it was going to take me, right? I just wanted a way for it to be separate from my normal life. I work for a large corporation in the States. I contract for them, and I didn't want any chance of it having anything to do with them. I tried to play my cards as close to the chest as I could just so that I wasn't risking. At the time, I thought my own personal safety might be a risk. And so that was part of it.
At this point, Stuart looks at me. What Wegg is saying exactly matches up with his own experience. They'd both become paranoid that delving into the conspiracy theories put them in danger.
This was something that I toyed with, reading your information and looking at the conspiracy side of it. You know, it was a paranoia, especially being involved in the situation, so my name was there somewhere involved in it. You shared in that, then you thought there could be, if you were uncovering a government conspiracy, you could become a target of that government.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did that make you hesitate in continuing investigating at any stage?
Strangely, no.
but in another way, did you share that you were investigating this with other people you knew?
So that's a great question.
Just the community that you'd have worked in?
My closest friends knew. My immediate family knew. Mm-hmm. For one of the trips that I made out to Vegas prior to me moving there, I actually took my brother with me. He's well-studied in jiu-jitsu. So he was my safety. Yeah.
I raised my eyebrows at this point. I'd spoken back and forth to Wegg over several weeks, but I hadn't actually realized that he'd moved to Las Vegas for the conspiracy theories.
It was a huge decision. It was a huge decision. But it was very clear to me that it was what I was supposed to be doing with my life at that time. So I picked up my life and my dog and I moved to Las Vegas and lived in an apartment 3 miles from where the shooting took place, and very embedded there. Went to the Las Vegas police headquarters every week to get the evidence drops. It was like Wall Street Journal, CNN, Las Vegas Review Journal, and then there's just me. Every week I'd go in there, I'd be like, this is so bizarre that I was able to do this.
He was able to do so by using some unorthodox tactics.
Well, they seem to want press credentials, so I'll just make up a company and I'll just print out a press card and hopefully, like, I'll show you. Actually, one of the show and tell things, I think I
you had a press
wallet.
Card?
Yeah.
Did you actually?
Oh, yeah. So I had two of these printed out. I had a lanyard.
But isn't there also, and this is the flip side of it, there's a risk to that too,
which is,
you know, people who haven't had that experience of investigating stories like that, who risk putting things out that then subsequently aren't true and then cause harm. How do you mitigate that?
I don't think that there should be a way to stop citizen journalists from showing up at press conferences and evidence drops. I think it encourages pressure on the powers that be to just disseminate the information.
Wegg spent nearly 18 months in Las Vegas, spanning 2018 and 2019. He told very few people why he was really there.
If you just say, oh yeah, I was looking into conspiracy theories related to the Las Vegas shooting, and so I moved to Las Vegas. Like, if you just say that in one sentence, you sound legitimately like an insane person. And maybe I was, but I think there's a lot more backstory that seems a little less insane, maybe, for some. I think some people will still think it's pretty crazy to do what I did. And I think it's crazy to do what I did, but I also felt it was important to do those crazy things.
While turning into this alter ego Wegg did seem to give him purpose, meaning, and a niche community. He says he didn't profit financially. He just kept up his usual job remotely from Las Vegas. Both Stuart and I had the sense he was genuinely trying to find out what had happened.
How much was this for you about feeling like you weren't being told the truth? Because I think there's a really important question about the difference between conspiracy theory and then also when people legitimately feel like they're having information withheld from them.
The Las Vegas police weren't being transparent because they hadn't provided the evidence. So it wasn't like there was like a conspiracy around that. It was just like, we know that people had their body cams. You've referenced it in your report, but we don't have that information. And so them withholding that, it was a big problem. I mean, my personal feeling is that transparency disseminates power, the power of information. Instead of the power of information being held by, you know, a small group of people, it disseminates it to a broader group.
On that just debate, I know you don't debate very often, but they did have a massive process to go through in an investigation. So, you know, all these things do take time. To rush it out and it be wrong would have been worse than to have taken another week and put it out where it was, you know, better collated and better viewed as such.
Yeah. Did it come out as quickly as it could have? No. Am I forgiving that they had to do a lot of work to get it out? Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
I contacted the Las Vegas police force about this, and they directed me to their action report on the shooting. In it, they say that the police force is committed to maintaining transparency with the media and community during critical incidents, but say that this must be done correctly, and that security during large-scale incidents is important when it comes to maintaining the integrity of the investigation. I've encountered too many conspiracy theorists and trolls online to remember. They take various forms, but a lot of them post maliciously, and some go as far as suggesting those killed in shootings, like in Las Vegas, never really died, or that survivors like Stuart are paid crisis actors, people who play a part in a staged event. Wegg's conspiracy theories stopped short of that, but he was still able to reflect on the possible harm they could cause.
I feel like now you're really reflective about your content, about what you shared. How much did you think about how conspiracy theories could be harmful to people, or could be harmful to survivors who are trying to process something? How much did you factor that in, and how do you reflect on that now?
I think that there are real world dangers to conspiracy theorizing, if you want to call it that. So at the time, my thought was if we continued to focus on the facts and the evidence, that would help to keep people away from, you know, maybe taking action on things that were based on conspiracy and not fact-based. It was in the back of my mind because I felt like, okay, well, I'm emotionally stable and healthy, and I'm still like thinking there might be something going on here. If somebody was not in that situation, they're depressed or anxious, or, you know, they have mental problems and they come across this, that could cause the wrong kind of actions to be taken. So yeah, I was always in the back of my mind that that was a possibility.
As we're talking, Wegg looks away and his speech slows down. He's suddenly become more emotional.
One of the reasons that I tried to keep people, when somebody would come with me with a far-fetched theory, that I would try to say, okay, well, what's the evidence? What are the facts? And put out those educational videos to try to help educate people to stay grounded when it comes to those things. And now I look back and I'm like, should I have kept all those videos up? I don't know if they're, you know, glorifying some of the things that happened. I hope not.
And I know, Stuart, we chatted about the degree to which you actually felt this started to become too much. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you want to tell Wegg a little bit about that?
It was the vessel for me to search for the answer. Do you know what I mean? So, as I say, I would wait and see any comment that would come up. You know, I'd have the notifications on Twitter mm-hmm. to see your information coming through. I would be at the page instantly. I mean, my real life would stop what I'm doing to keep up with what was going on. You know, the rabbit hole I was falling down in, and thankfully counselling and stuff pulled me back out of that, getting counselled for mental health.
Oh, yeah. Okay, great.
To try and get back out of that. But at that time, this, as I say, was a crutch that I would have used. Do you know what I mean? This information coming out to try and make peace with what was going on. This, to me, could have led to me finding out what was wrong overall. So it was very important.
I think it's interesting because, you know, having spoken to both of you, in some ways, you kind of entered the world of conspiracy and have both kind of come out the other side.
Yeah.
To what degree do you think conspiracy theories were and are important to that process?
It's normal for us to question and to try to fill in gaps with story. You can't be human without that. I think the fact that people come up with conspiracy theories, it's not something that's going to go away. I think what can go away is how those people know to approach the theories that they have in meaningful ways that push the conversation forward. And then two, having authorities and powers that be being transparent about why you can't be fully transparent.
It's like how to be an ethical conspiracy theorist.
Yes.
The term conspiracy theorist is one that has quite a lot of negative connotations. What do you think about the very valid reasons it has negative connotations? Because there are some people who do take it to really extreme places. What's the way of changing the perception of conspiracy theorists, quote unquote?
Well, yeah, I don't know is the answer. But I think that my intuition is that if more people do things ethically, I think that that might change the conversation, or at least broaden the range of what that can mean. Or there just needs to be a new term for it, you know, conspiracy researcher. I call myself that sometimes. Like, I feel like I'm a conspiracy researcher versus theorist, you know, in that I think that grounds me more, or helps to convey that I was more grounded in reality with what I was doing, being more fact-based.
One of the central questions that we're interrogating in this podcast is this question of why do you hate me? And in this case, that you might think that, I don't know, Stuart might hate someone who's making that kind of content, or you might hate people who you think are part of a cover-up. And actually, in this case, it seems like the absolute opposite, that kind of no one hates anyone. Yeah. And I don't know what you kind of have to say on that question of if it's changed perhaps how you view this, or if it's offered you any kind of resolution or conclusion.
A lot of people would look at this on paper and think that we should probably hate each other. The fact that we don't, it gives me a lot of hope.
What have you taken from this, Stuart?
It's one thing I wanted. I wanted it to be a decent person who was running this experience, because I got a good bit out of the experience. And the worst thing for me would have been somebody who didn't sort of share the same journey as myself. I wanted to know what spurred you on to do it, because I didn't think you had an attachment to it in any way, but you've given your attachments to it, and it just helps in that closing that chapter off then that it was done by a decent guy.
My chat with Stuart and Wegg lasted for more than 2 hours. I was struck by how having the conversation face-to-face rather than online led to moments of real reflection and candour between the two men. At its heart, this is about two people who became consumed by a horrific shooting that they couldn't make sense of. Stuart wanted to find a way to rationalise an event that caused him trauma. Wegg couldn't accept the gaps in the official narrative and wanted to find his own version of the truth. This led to both of them believing conspiracy theories they now broadly accept aren't true. I imagine that at least some of you listening can relate to that. I definitely can. When bad things happen, it can be reassuring to find a narrative to explain why they did. The concept of the ethical conspiracy theorist interests me, but the question of whether they can operate in a way that avoids causing harm, particularly to those who've already lived through some of the worst things imaginable, remains an open one. The real-world harm triggered by conspiracy theories on social media already has a long history. What's new is the way artificial intelligence is being used to spread disinformation and hate. On the next episode, I'm investigating a fake clip of London Mayor Sadiq Khan that did just that.
There was this video circulating, audio really, on Twitter of me claiming arms and state doesn't matter, protest for Palestine is far more important. And you initially think, well, it's clearly a fake, insignificant. And I listened to it. And the person voicing me, I've got to be honest, did sound a lot like me.
That's on the next episode of Radio 4's Why Do You Hate Me? Available on BBC Sounds.
The Post Office Horizon scandal has shocked Britain.
Post Office IT scandal, which has had so much publicity, hasn't it, over the last...
This is a scandal of historic proportions.
I've been following the story for more than a decade, hearing about the suffering of sub-postmasters like Joe Hamilton and Alan Bates.
It was just horrendous. The whole thing was horrendous.
I was told you can't afford to take on Post Office.
And about their extraordinary fight for justice.
What was motivating you?
Well, it was wrong what they did.
Listen to the true story firsthand from the people who lived it in the Great Post Office Trial from BBC Radio 4 with me, Nick Wallace. Subscribe on BBC Sounds.